And so bringing up some of this, not that it has anything to do with the Gospel of John, it really doesn't. But I just want us to understand some things about the Apostle John and understand what are some things that were significant in his life, perhaps during the time that he writes the letter or the Gospel of John, the book of John. And so we went through several of these photos already. So I'll flip through some of them kind of quick and then take up where we left off. This is just the harbor there that near Ephesus. Zach, this is not the picture you were talking about, is it? This one? Was it that one? Okay. This just being kind of a long-range view, looking way out there at what would be the harbor of Ephesus, though the ancient city of Ephesus is actually over here, you know, is where it is at now. We're just trying to get a perspective of some things. We talked briefly here about St. John's Basilica in Ephesus. That, yeah, men have looked at Ephesus as being a significant place in the life of the Apostle John, so they're going to honor him by building him a church there, you know, is what we found. And in fact, tradition would have it that John is buried here at this in this location. This is St. John's Basilica, what is left of that. In touching on the point again, John was exiled, you know, to Patmos. We talked about that already, you know, probably in the 90 to 95 A.D. Time range is when that would have been. I want to find this. This right here would be the gravesite, that they would say, of the Apostle John. And, you know, and when you look at tradition, on a lot of these kinds of things, you have to go by what historians of that day had to say. And you go back to the second century, and there are several historians that would say that John died in Ephesus and that he was buried there in Ephesus. I mean, is this the spot where he was buried? I don't know. I mean, it could be. It doesn't really matter if it is or not. But it's kind of interesting that, you know, history all the way back to the second century would record such a thing as that, a little closer view of this. This right here is in Ephesus, looking across over at the old city of Ephesus in the area where the Temple of Artemis was at. Temple of Artemis. Well, what else might we know the Temple of Artemis as?
Diana.
Diana, Temple of, that the Romans would have called it Diana, the goddess Diana. Well, of course, that would have been very prevalent in the time of John. John doesn't really have anything to say about that in his writings. The Apostle Paul had some interaction, you know, in Ephesus. Because remember, now wait, let's back up for a second. Now, we said on Sunday, some have said that John was probably in Ephesus during the AD 40s time frame, because he was, or late AD 40s, he was in Jerusalem prior to that. He lived in Jerusalem. But during the mid to late AD 40s, he was here in Ephesus. Then some have said that he and Peter traveled, you know, a great deal throughout Asia Minor teaching. And John would have been very familiar with those other cities that we identified a while ago. And then Paul was in Ephesus, remember? During like the early AD 50s or late 40s, the Apostle Paul was in Ephesus. He was there for 3 years, we find, you know, in the book of Acts. And was John there at the same time as Paul? Well, I don't know. Could they have traveled in and out and seen each other? Don't really know. But then later, when Paul was not in Ephesus anymore, it seems John came back. And it seems that through the late AD 50s and maybe in the 60s, John was in Ephesus again. John spent more time in Ephesus than Paul did, is what most historians would say. But this is kind of interesting, this Temple of Artemis, and some of the remains that was there. Paul had a direct interaction with some in the book of Acts that were all tore up here about the princess, or the goddess Diana, you know. And so it would have been here where that took place. Nothing is said about John, you know, being there at that time. But when he was in Ephesus, all of these structures would have been there. And the Temple of Artemis or Diana would have been just as big when John was there. Just some other remnants there of the temple in Ephesus. it was a big temple, just a few things there. It would have been quite a sight. In fact, I read somewhere that for a while it was considered one of the seven wonders of the world, the Temple Diana. I mean, it was a pretty large as far as size, almost 200 feet wide or long, I forget which, 106 columns. There wasn't a roof on it, but there were just the columns. You don't have to, when, a lot of times in some of these old ancient building places, there's a lot of columns. Do not infer that there was a roof over top of it. There was just columns that kind of outlined a courtyard area, maybe, or something like that. But it must have been quite the sight, you know, for it to be a travel destination for people to come to, whether it was to come and to worship the goddess Diana or just to come and see the temple. It would have been like a travel destination, you know, in one way or the other, for that. And so, I mean, of course, I mean, John would have seen all of that too. And then there was, of course, you know, the riot that took place in Acts chapter 19. No, that wasn't with the Apostle John, but Paul was there. I mean, there was quite a riot that took place there, because it would seem, what the text would tell us, is that there were some who were feeling some pressure from, maybe from those Christians who were not following the temple or the goddess Diana. And it was cutting into revenues of the silversmiths and those who were making, you know, the little idols that they worshipped. And so it was right there in the city where, sidetrack for a minute. Don't lose the thought on that. Hold on. Sidetrack, I'm right here. Some say that Luke is also buried in Ephesus and that this is his tomb. And part of how they come by that is some of the inscriptions and stuff that's on like this tombstone. Is that true or not? I don't know. But it was in the slides. I just wanted to make a point of that. And so going back to this temple area and all of that, this is part of the layout of the old city of Ephesus right here, the civic agora, which is like the marketplace. There were two marketplaces in Ephesus. The civic one, which I guess I would take that as just the one that the locals, the community, went to the marketplace. And then there is a large commercial marketplace back over here. But here's a couple of things to think about. Here's the civic marketplace. Here is a small theater right there, small, only seats about 4,000. That's a small theater. But there's a larger one that's over here, closer to this commercial marketplace, over that way. You know, the big uproar in Acts chapter 19, you know, over the goddess Diana and those who are feeling their trade being pressed, maybe because of the Christians. Where do you suppose that uproar took place? And we can identify a marketplace, and they gathered where in the big dispute? Where did they go?
Was it the temple? I mean,
they went to the theater. But there's two theaters. Yeah, the agora, the marketplace. But which one? And we can't answer this. We don't know. But I wonder about these. Does anybody else wonder about these things besides me? You know, I mean, you have like the civic marketplace here. And over here you have the commercial one. I wonder where they were selling and where was all the trade taking place for these little gods or these figurines or whatever it was that they were selling. Well, I'm sure it was available in both places, but there was this commercial one over here, and there's a bigger theater over on that side. This is the small theater. This is the community side, so to speak. You know, take right here. This is the small theater again. And just some of the streets here, like Main Street, so to speak, through the community marketplace. Kind of interesting. A lot of pillars going up and down through there. I can only imagine. You know, Ephesus was quite the town back in the day in the first century. I mean, it was a major port city. If you're coming in and out of Central Asia Minor, Ephesus is where you would come in and out of. And this wasn't so far from the harbor. There would have been a lot of trade, a lot of people. I think I can understand why the Apostle John would have spent years there and why Paul would have spent time there. Because people coming in and out of Asia Minor, you'd have had contact with so many people in Ephesus. Just some of the remnants around Ephesus here. This is, they say, part of the old town hall that was there in these streets. I can't tell exactly if that's stone or if that's marble, what those are made out of. Some of these mosaics, I don't know if that's first century or not, or if that's a little bit later, but they're very old, whatever they are. And this library, which is, you know, quite impressive, that actually wasn't built, I think, until about the mid-second century. So this would have been after Paul and John, before this was built. But here's what I was trying to get to. Over near the commercial marketplace is this huge theater over here. And when you read, like, Acts chapter 19, and the dispute that took place there over the selling of their figurine, their goddess Diana, I wonder where that took place. Because, I mean, it makes it sound like there was a lot of people in the theater. Well, a lot of people in the small theater, you know, it held 4,000. I don't even know how many this I read, but I can't remember how many thousands of this bigger theater holds. And, I mean, the way it's described in the text, and it was quite an uproar, you know, that was going on. Can't you just stop and think for a minute and look at that and just try to picture the Apostle Paul and some of the disciples there kind of in the middle of all of that uproar that was going on. And it was kind of a calm city clerk or something like that kind of came in and calmed the crowd, remember, got them to be dispersed. And Paul got away okay, unscathed. But he left town the next day. It was time to leave after, you know, that big uproar, that dispute. What's that got to do with the Apostle John? All we're saying is, this is where the Apostle John lived for a number of years. And these are some of the sights and some of the scenes that he would have been familiar with, that he would have known when he lived there. He would have seen Ephesus in all of its grandeur, really. And it would have been quite, an impressive town. Zach, that's not the picture you wanted, is it? It was that first one. Okay, all right. Some other events, just real quick. You know, some other events that took place in Ephesus. We can read through the book of Acts, and we can see a number of times. I meant to try to count it up, and I just never got to that. A number of times that the Apostle Paul comes in and out of Ephesus. Sometimes it seems as though he's just kind of coming through Ephesus on his way someplace else. And again, it's like, I explained it to someone, I'm not sure if this is exactly right or not, but this is the way it kind of works in my mind. In this part of the country, if you want to go much any place flying, you're going to go through Atlanta, right? You've got to get to Atlanta to go someplace else in a lot of cases. And that's kind of the way I think Ephesus was. If you were going by sea, you know, to any place, you'd kind of have to come through Ephesus on your way to get to the next ship that would take you over here or the ship that would take you over there. And if you were coming into Asia Minor, to the central part of Asia Minor, you'd come through Ephesus. I mean, it was just a place to kind of come through. And so, you know, different times we can see in the text where Paul came to Ephesus. Apollos came to Ephesus, remember, and he was teaching in Acts chapter 18 when Priscilla and Aquila were there and taught him the way of the Lord more perfectly, remember, in Acts chapter 18. And Paul had been in Ephesus in chapter 18, but then he left. In the first part of chapter 19, here he comes back again, kind of following up after Apollos, you know, teaching there again, just in and out in his travels coming through. Don't you wonder a little bit about how many other disciples that are unnamed came in and out and through Ephesus in the time Paul lived there for 3 years, or in the many years that John lived there in the 40s and late 50s and 60s, when the Apostle John lived there, how many disciples came through and he talked to and had influence with or studied with, you know, as they were coming through? I don't know. Just some things to kind of think about and to have in mind. Paul was there in the late 50s. In AD 57, in the spring of 57, is when some have kind of pegged, well, that's when he wrote 1 Corinthians there from Ephesus. You know, that may be right. It would be later that as he was traveling home on his third missionary journey, that he didn't have time to stop in Ephesus because he was trying to get to Jerusalem for the Passover. But he stopped at the next port down in Miletus, and he called for the elders from Ephesus to come to him, and they did. They came across land and came to see him, and he met with them one last time as he was on his way out. Paul's life was getting short at that point. And so, anyway, just some things. Jamie, can we go back to the beginning of that for a second? I need to cue up a slide here for Zach. I don't know. I hope we didn't spend too much time on that, but I just thought it was some interesting things for us to kind of to see and to get in mind here about Paul. There we go. All right. Okay. Well, now let's go to the book of John. And I've been talking about the book of John and, as if John is the writer of the book of John. And I believe he is. But how do we get there? I mean, how do we come to the point of seeing or believing that the Apostle John is the writer of that? That's what I want to talk about some tonight. On lesson one, page one, just some introductory remarks for us to think about here. When you look at the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, I mean, basically they cover the same period of time. Basically, they're all covering the life, you know, the ministry, the death, resurrection of Jesus. And they all have a lot in common as far as some of the events that they talk about. But each writer writes a little bit differently and places some emphasis sometimes on different points. Perhaps certain aspects of the storyline that was more pertinent to them, maybe, or something that they were more involved in than others might have been. And the personality of each of the writers becomes quite distinct when we consider Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Four different men and four different personalities, four different styles of writing. And maybe even a little bit different slant or purpose in their writing. Yes, they're all talking about the same person. They're all talking about Jesus. And they're all explaining, you know, his life and ministry. But from a little bit different view. I mean, it's just like if you take four of us out of this group right here, and we are all witness to a story, and you take all four of us separately, and we all write down the story. We may all write about the same story, but what one person saw as very important in the story might be a little bit different than what somebody else would see. Or maybe the relationship that one has with some event that took place may make that story more significant to them than one of the others who just walked up on it. I mean, we can understand how that would be just in life in general. We might think of the Gospels that way too. And John has a unique perspective of the life of Christ. And we see that as it unfolds in his writing. The Gospel of John proposes to set forth evidence that sustains the factuality of Jesus being the Christ, the Son of God. It is a book that very much is written in such a way to prove the point that Jesus is the Son of God. I'm not saying that the other Gospels don't do the same, but this is a point of emphasis for John. If in the beginning comments and the ending comments and many that are in between are said and written in such a way as if he is trying to lay before us, here are the facts, here is the evidence. This is indisputable, undisputable evidence. And he makes that from the standpoint of being able to say, I was there. And he relies on that at different times. He was an eyewitness. I mean, he was there. And it's as though he wants to make sure that we understand that he was an eyewitness. Now, we understand the power of an eyewitness. Back in the fire department days, you know, often you come up on the scene of an accident. Sometimes you get there before PD gets there, before the police get there. And if somebody is saying, I witnessed this, you're trying to encourage them, could you sit right here by the unit, by the truck, and just wait for a few minutes for police because they're going to want to talk with you. Why? Because they saw what happened. Now, if they were to explain it to me, and this happens sometimes, like, look, I've got to get to work. Here's what happened. And they explain it to me. And I can relay that to a sheriff's deputy or something like that. I can give them some information. But it does not carry the same weight as the witness. We see that, don't we? And so John uses this as a point to bring some power and punch to what he is saying and what he is writing. It's like he's saying, I was there. I want to tell you about some things I saw. Jesus the Christ, the Son of the living God. I know that this is the Son of God because I witnessed the signs and the wonders he did. I heard the things that he did. I saw others who became convinced of this same thing. I was there. I was a witness. That's the perspective of John's writing. And it becomes very powerful. It's compelling writing. And it's written in such a way that, number one, we know that John was convinced that Jesus was the Son of God. We understand that the events that took place convinced others that Jesus was the Son of God. And now, as John would say, these things are written. These things have been preserved. These are written so that you, man, you being us, so that we can understand that Jesus is the Son of God. That's the power of John's writing and the purpose of his writing. You know, in great libraries, there are a lot of books of apologetics, as they would say, or evidences that have been written about Jesus. And they might be very powerful writings. But none of them can be as convincing as an eyewitness account. There are some historians that have written some very compelling stories about Christ and events that took place as they have heard from others. And that's interesting. And it can be compelling, yes. But not as much so as the eyewitness account itself. That is John's perspective in writing. But all of that being said, and I have said over and over again, here's John's perspective in writing. And yet, there's still a question I want us to back up and deal with here for a few minutes. The starting point of our study is to know something about the writer of the book, which leads us up to the preliminary question, who is the writer of the Gospel of John? Well, you've already got the clue that I'm pretty convinced that it's the Apostle John. But how do we know that? Because when you go through the text, John doesn't identify himself as the writer. At least, he doesn't, as like the Apostle Paul has done. I, Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, as he starts a number of his letters, he kind of narrows down who the author is. John doesn't do that. And so, I mean, in my mind, that kind of makes it more difficult to try to ascertain who, in fact, is the writer of the book. I wish he just said, I did it. You know, and that, of course, people argue that too. I mean, you go to every one of the epistles where the Apostle Paul says, I wrote it, and every one of them, there are great arguments as to why Paul wasn't the writer, but someone else was. Okay? I mean, that happens in every case. And so they would argue this one too. But for the simple-minded, it would be a lot easier. So how do we answer this? I'm going to suggest, you know, there's a couple of different ways. First, external evidence. And what I've written here, what I mean by that, is evidence that comes somewhere besides the inspired word. And I spent way too much time reading some things about the external evidence, because there's tons of stuff as far as external evidence goes. And you can go through all kinds of books, and you can spend forever on the internet looking at the external evidence to the authorship of the Gospel of John. And it's pretty amazing how much you can come up with. And so, you know, there's many non-biblical proofs, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But it's also so interesting to me how much of the external evidence points to the Apostle John, the son of Zebedee, as being the writer of the book of John. There are several reasons for that. Some have tried to assert that the book was written as late as the 3rd century. Here's an argument of some. It couldn't have been written by John, the apostle, because these words were not penned until the 3rd century. Some have said the 4th century before this gospel was written. Well, there's some problems with that. External evidence tells us there's a problem with that theory. In the early 2nd century, there were historians that were already making reference to things written in the Gospel of John. You know, so it couldn't have been written in the 3rd or 4th century because people are already referring to it in the 2nd century. And this becomes some of the strong external evidence right there. And we're talking about 2nd history historians like Clement and Tertullian and Irenaeus. You know, we're talking about some pretty powerful hitters in the realm of historians of that day. And they're all writing some very compelling things about the gospel that John wrote and making references to the things that was written. And we're talking, you know, only a century, or perhaps less than a century from the day that John wrote it. And then what was really interesting was Irenaeus, one of these historians, was a pupil of another historian and church father, Polycarp. Well, Polycarp was himself a disciple of John and spent a lot of time with the Apostle John. Don't you suppose Polycarp would know who wrote the Gospel of John? All the time that they spent together and studied together and worked together. And so you actually have a connection from John to Polycarp to Irenaeus, those early historians. Polycarp was still alive when those historians were writing, you know, the history of the 1st century and could talk about those things. And there are others too. I tried to narrow down a ton of reading and study into 3 short paragraphs here. I hope you appreciate that. It took a ton of time to put it in 3 short paragraphs. But that sort of sums up some of the external evidence. And there's a lot of it. And that's just impressive to me. That 3rd paragraph under external evidence. Other apologists of the early 2nd century bear witness that the things written in the 4th gospel lends itself to being written at an earlier date, not the 2nd, 3rd century, as some would assert. Most ascribe the date of 75 to 90 A.D. for the time John penned his gospel account. Now, that may be right. I mean, we're never going to know that exactly, but it would be kind of interesting. That would likely have been when he was in Ephesus again, all those pictures of Ephesus. It was probably when he was in Ephesus that second time for a long period of time when he wrote, you know, the Gospel of John. There are some who say that he didn't write the Gospel of John until he was on the Isle of Patmos. And I understand, you know, there's maybe even some evidence for that, but not as much as the earlier date, 75 to 90 A.D. Well, what about internal evidence? And I'm actually pretty interested in the internal evidence. And what I mean by that is, what does the book itself tell us about its authorship? Because here again, John never said, I, John, am apostle of Jesus Christ. I wish he did. But he doesn't start the book that way. Not at all. And so it's interesting just to see what the book itself has to say on that. And so we'll look at a couple of passages here, and you can draw some conclusions, you know, on what you think of it. And you just have to do some deduction here to kind of work it through. And to me, in my mind, it's not the clearest thing in the world. It's just not. Keep in mind as we think about this that the author, and I think this is kind of an important point, the author remains anonymous throughout. I mean, the writer never refers himself, as here it's me, I'm the writer type of a thing. There are others who are talked about, in the first person, so to speak. But the writer doesn't really identify himself that way. And so the fact that the author remains anonymous throughout actually helps to eliminate some possible writers. It kind of, I think, kind of helps us to narrow it down to one. And I think some of the evidence that has to be considered here is to first consider those of the 12, that is, of the apostles, who had a close relationship, who had the closest relationship with the Lord. I mean, there were 12 apostles. One became no more, Judas. And then there was Matthias that was added, and then later Paul. But during the life and times of Jesus that we will read about in the book of John, well, that was before Matthias, and it was before Paul. Well, those are eliminated. So that kind of narrows us down to 11, basically. There's no indication that it would have been Judas that wrote this, particularly by some of the things that it said. So that narrows us down to 10, really, at that point. On our page 2 of your outline, some of the continuing thoughts on external evidence. There were 3 apostles that seem to have had the closest relationship with John. There was Peter, James, and John that you seem to find together a number of times. I mean, even in the book of Acts, we're going to find Peter and John together a lot. We're going to read about James as well in the book of Acts. But these were the ones who seemed to be the closest to the Lord. Well, it could be, part of it is, I think these Peter, James, and John had a relationship before Jesus. They all shared some things in common. And in fact, they may very well all been a kinship. They worked together, but it may even been beyond that. But imagine for a moment just being a part of that inner circle with the Lord. We're going from the book of John to Matthew chapter 17. That is not the bell. Is it really?
Man.
Yeah, I'm going like, that's not the bell. And y'all are going, oh, finally, there's hope. There's relief coming. Matthew chapter 17, Transfiguration of Christ. Always just an incredibly interesting story to me. Matthew 17, verse 1. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, and brought them up on a high mountain by themselves and was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with him. Then Peter answered and said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, let us make here 3 tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. And while he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. And suddenly a voice came out of the cloud saying, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear him. Well, there's 3 there that hear that. Peter, James, and John's going to make some reference to, I think, this event. Peter certainly does in his writing. Is it 1 Peter or 2 Peter? He says 2 Peter, I think it is, Eddie. No, I mean it's 1 Peter. I forget now. 1 Peter or 2 Peter? Peter makes a very strong reference to this event, what he saw and heard the voice that came from heaven. Now, James, I don't see anything where James said anything. James didn't really write any epistle. In fact, James is the one who died early. In fact, 12th chapter of Acts. you know, he was the first of the apostles to die, which I think was in about 42 A.D. Well, most say this book wasn't written until 75 to 90 A.D. So we can probably eliminate James as the writer of the book, right? Even though he saw this event. And as you read through the book of John, the author is anonymous, never identifies himself. But Peter is identified a number of times in the book. And Peter talks of, he was there, but he talks about this book in his own letters. And so it doesn't seem likely to me that Peter is the writer of the book of John, as we call it, the book of John. There's some things there that just don't really seem to fit or add up. You know, the writer of John mentions time and again bearing witness to the things of Christ. All of the apostles could have said that. But there were just some things that Peter, James, and John saw that all the rest of them didn't see. This transfiguration being one of them. There were some things that they were kind of extra privy to. That it seems as though their relationship with the Lord was a little bit different, more intimate in that way. And as we said, Peter was moved by the things of the Lord. He confirmed that he was a witness too. Yeah, there's my notes. It's in 2 Peter chapter 1 that he makes account and speaks of this, you know, right here. And so of those of the closest circle around Jesus, James is eliminated for sure because he's killed. And Peter, it seems to me, is eliminated just in the way that it's written, because the writer doesn't identify himself but speaks of himself kind of in a third person type of a thing. And when Peter is talked about, it's not in that way. So it seems to me as though Peter is being eliminated from that too. But the stronger evidence in this comes in some passages from the book of John. About the middle here of your worksheet, page 2, you know, passages from John 21 and John 13, which we're not going to get to tonight. But that kind of becomes our starting point on Sunday morning, Lord willing, as we still kind of work through some of the internal evidences, trying to understand who is the writer of the book of John. So for preparation on Sunday, finish up this worksheet, and then we're going to the text, chapter 1. You know, I'm going to tell you right now, I have found the first 14 verses of Acts chapter 1 to be pretty difficult to work my way through. And I haven't thought of them as being so difficult before, but I do now, trying to figure out how to teach that in a class type situation. I think some of the rest of the book of John, I think, will become more interesting to me as it gets into more of a story form, as we get into the life of Jesus. The first 12 or 14 verses are not so much a story of the life of Jesus as we get into in the latter part. So just a little precursor of what we're doing. Look at the first part of the book of John and read that over, and make sure you got lesson 2.